This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry.
We heard what I thought was firecrackers, and there was a surge of screaming people heading in the opposite direction, so we just followed on with them.
This terrorist attack is once again a very violent act, an absolutely violent act, and it is quite clear that we must do everything to fight.
Another attack in France overnight, this time in the coastal city of Nice on the French Riviera. A man who French police have identified as a 31-year-old French Tunisian drove his 9-ton truck into crowds gathered to watch Bastille Day fireworks. At least 84 people have been killed, including two Americans, a father and a son from Lakeway, Texas. French President François Hollande announced that France would extend the country's state of emergency, which had been in effect since Islamist terrorists killed over 100 people at a concert in Paris last November. Kieran Fahy is a reporter for the Associated Press. He's based in Berlin. He arrived in Nice yesterday morning for a vacation of his own.
I happened to be in a restaurant at the time, just around the corner from the Promenade des Anglais, the promenade where the attack took place. And the first thing I noticed was just a lot of people running past and suddenly bursting into the restaurant. Just the sheer panic. So people were running as fast as they could. Many people were crying. People were screaming. And it was just a scene of utter chaos at that stage.
Kieran Fahy, the French people were breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief because the Euro Cup soccer tournament had just gone off without a terrorist incident. And of course, people were very concerned that such a high profile world event would be a target.
That's true. I mean, the security had been extremely, extremely tight for the soccer tournament. So that went on for a month. Over a month, just finished recently. I think the final was 7th of July. So there was a huge sigh of relief that managed to pass off without any incident. There had been a state of emergency in France for pretty much since the November attacks in Paris. And there has been a constant state of emergency, which was extended to cover the European soccer tournament as well. And that has been extended now again by another 3 months because of the attacks yesterday.
And what are French people preparing for now in the days to come? The state of emergency extended, as you said, but François Hollande also said that he was activating essentially the reserves in France to join the police, which means a lot of military reservists may now find themselves on the streets with guns guarding people.
French people, I think, are actually used to it already because for the football tournament, I mean, there was quite a visible presence of soldiers with guns. I mean, pretty much every street corner in the major cities, you have soldiers with guns. Every train station, you would have soldiers with guns patrolling around. And I think French people are very, I don't want to say that they've become used to it, but almost that they've accepted that this is almost a new reality.
Kieran Fahy is a reporter for the Associated Press. He joined us from Nice in France. France has already been under a state of emergency since the attacks in Paris last November and had been on high alert during the European soccer tournament there last month. Security officials internationally are tightening counterterrorism measures, but the nature of this attack in Nice raises the question of whether incidents like it can actually be stopped. Martin Reardon is a 21-year veteran of the FBI with extensive experience in counterterrorism and criminal investigations. He's currently senior vice president at the Soufan Group. Martin Reardon says it's impossible to prevent these types of attacks, especially when the weapon is a simple truck traveling at just 30 miles an hour.
There was a large police presence there, and there has been a large police presence at all these major events, going back for the last year. But this is something that generally, it's not expected. This is the first major terrorist attack involving just a vehicle, using it to run over people, on record. I mean, there was another one that was in September 2014, as you recall, just south of Montreal, where a self-radicalized convert to Islam, Martin Coulter Rouleau, ran over two soldiers with his car, killing one. And that was a direct result of an online statement made by Islamic State's media person, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, previous month, asking followers worldwide to, if they can't go to Iraq or Syria, to attack Western countries, you know, or their own countries at home. If they use bomb, use a bomb. If not, use a handgun or a shoulder fire weapon. If not that, a knife, or even run them over with a car. That was specifically mentioned. And then a month later, this incident in Montreal. So how do you prevent an attack like that, particularly, and it's still early in this most recent attack in France, but particularly if it's a lone wolf, an individual that has just decided at that time and place he's going to do this, or a short time before decided that at this particular event he's going to use a vehicle to run people over at a large public venue and kill them.
And that makes me think, Martin Reardon, that there are features of this attack, at least from what we know right now, that are reminiscent of Orlando last month. I mean, a truck is easy to get in France like anywhere else. Guns are relatively easy to get in this country. But an individual who wants to inflict terror and mayhem, if they have access to something lethal, it does make it almost unavoidable.
It is. And in this particular case, I mean, how less sophisticated and simple can it be to use a vehicle, not worry about explosives, not worry about weapons? And apparently he did have weapons in the vehicle, although some reporting is that they were not even real, or at least some of them were not real. But to use a vehicle simply to run people over to kill them. Something difficult to prevent. And even in a major event like this, if roads were blocked off the traffic, the major event was over, so those roads would be opened back up again. I mean, this is a city, and there are roads where, you know, vehicles have to use. So although you can shut down the traffic during their major event, in this particular case, the fireworks display was over. People were leaving. They need to get back into their vehicles and go home.
And so for a security expert like you, what do you make of the politics coming from the top, where French officials in the aftermath here have told French people largely what you and I are talking about, which is to get used to it? That's something you might not hear in the United States.
I hate to use the term the new normal, because we don't want this to be normal. But I think whether you're in France or in the UK or in the United States, we have to accept that there are going to be terrorist attacks that will continue to go, like we've seen in Orlando, like we've seen in San Bernardino. These attacks are going to continue. What law enforcement and intelligence can do, or all they can do, is identify cells that are out there or individuals that may be identified, and then follow up investigation. They're under scrutiny, and perhaps they can thwart this. And the FBI has done this on numerous occasions the last several years through undercover cases, where they've approached the individual, the suspect, and using an undercover agent have had them commit overt acts to the extent that they could be arrested and indicted and charged with terrorism. But in these other cases, if the individual's under the radar screen, there's really nothing you can do. They'll decide, and if you block off traffic at a major event, they'll just wait and do it someplace else. I mean, this attack, as horrible as it was so simple. All it required you to do was get in the vehicle and drive. You know, I hate to think that there could be a copycat here, that now that it's been done and it's been successful, other individuals may decide this is the way to go, the less risky method of not being compromised beforehand.
Martin Reardon, Senior Vice President at the Soufan Group, thank you for your help.
You're welcome.
Well, Donald Trump has made his announcement. His VP pick, Indiana conservative Republican Governor Mike Pence, is the choice. Pence was one of the names on Donald Trump's purported shortlist at the end, with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Matt Katz has been covering the Trump campaign for our co-producer WNYC, and he's with me now. Hi, Matt.
Hi there, Todd.
What does Mike Pence bring to the table here for Donald Trump?
He brings conservative bona fides. He's appreciated by the conservative, particularly religious conservatives in this country. He also has experience. He's got a pretty good resume, was a congressman, is now a governor, so he has both legislative and executive experience. He also sort of looks like a president, which I think is something that Trump might have appealed to Trump. And he's more of a known quantity, like you know what you're going to get from him. You you know what he's going to say, then maybe Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, the other two finalists, then those two guys might have brought. There was probably some concern about them. He is what any reasonable advisor to Trump would have recommended.
And how does he appear sort of as a running mate to Trump? You know, there's always a comparison between the two candidates. You don't want somebody who overshadows the principal, and you need somebody who can be supportive and also attack the opponents.
Right. I don't think he's going to make much of a splash. Part of Trump, it seemed, wanted somebody dynamic who can also control the stage like Trump does. Pence is no, you know, he's not a wilting flower here. I mean, he used to be a conservative talk radio host. He knows his way around a microphone, but he's not going to, you know, rile a crowd up or make outlandish statements that are going to dominate the news cycle. That'll be Trump's job. Some things will have to be reconciled. The fact that they have different opinions on a variety of topics is something they're both going to have to answer to. I mean, as an example, Pence had said that Trump's proposed ban on Muslim immigration was unconstitutional. You'd expect Pence to have an answer for something like that. Also, Trump has made some of the most progressive remarks about the LGBT community of any Republican ever. It's one of the demographic groups in our country that Trump has not angered, and yet Pence assigned a law that allows business owners to not serve gays, and that was last year, and that is really what Pence is known for in a large parts of the country, and it really upset the gay community. So there's that sort of variance there too that will have to be reconciled. I just don't really expect him to take a very large dominant role in this campaign like Newt Gingrich or Chris Christie on the ticket would have.
And there's no geographical advantage. Indiana is Republican territory in any presidential election, so it's not like Pence delivers a state that Donald Trump really wants to take away from Hillary Clinton. So it seems like his sole purpose is shoring up the parts of the Republican electorate, Christian conservatives, evangelicals, who have been very, very slow to warm to Donald Trump, if not cool altogether.
Yeah, and elected Republicans in Washington. You already heard Speaker Paul Ryan said that he was very happy with this pick. I think a lot of Republicans like Ryan who want to support the nominee breathed a sigh of relief that Pence was picked.
At the same time, Matt Katz, while we're talking about the quality of the Mike Pence pick, the drama around actually announcing the pick, which Donald Trump had put off in light of the terrorist attacks in Nice, he then wound up coming back and announcing it before he was set to announce it in the first place when he canceled it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a mess, and it was really reflective of the campaign in so many respects so far. Trump said he wasn't going to announce the pick on Friday at 11 o'clock Eastern time, as he had planned, out of respect to those who were killed in France. And yet at 10:50 a.m., 10 minutes before he was supposed to have the press conference with the pick initially, he tweets it out. So he ended up doing it earlier than planned, even though he said he was going to postpone it. Very bizarre turn of events. Also, there didn't seem to be much planning behind the rollout. It wasn't on his homepage, his website. When he tweeted it out, he didn't tag the Pence, which is important because Trump has millions and millions of followers, and you want your followers to start to associate you with your running mate. There were a whole range of just basic social media and communications functions that you do when you roll out a big announcement like this that Trump failed to do. So it really seemed to be haphazard. I mean, you had conflicting reports for the 24 hours preceding it about whether or not he'd even made a final decision. You had his staffer saying he made a final decision. You had Trump saying he wasn't sure. He was still picking between two or four or three people. Really bizarre. But, you know, that's what we got to come to expect from this campaign.
So it seems like there's been a great deal of impulsivity leading up to this moment. I think going forward, Matt Katz, the critical question to answer here is, can Mike Pence, through his presence on the ticket, convince the so-called value voters, that Donald Trump is really one of them. I mean, it's one thing for Donald Trump to have Mike Pence on the ticket and say, look, I chose this guy. Paul Ryan's happy. But millions of evangelicals, they don't think Donald Trump is a real Christian. They don't think Donald Trump is really pro-life. Can Mike Pence help assuage that?
Probably can. And, you know, there are have been some recent polls that indicate that Trump, despite the three marriages, despite the positions on LGBTQ issues, has support among evangelicals. So this could certainly shore it up. Although, you know, historically, vice presidential nominees get a lot of attention initially, but don't necessarily sway a race. We know when it works against the candidate, like Sarah Palin with John McCain, where Republicans were really concerned about her on the ticket and some either didn't vote or went for Obama. But it's tough to find an example in recent history where people went out and voted for the president because they liked the vice president. And I don't know if you're going to see that now. At least he provides temporarily some comfort to establishment and conservative Republicans that, you know, he's not totally off the reservation.
Well, Donald Trump moving to shore up his right flank with his pick of conservative Republican Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate. Matt Katz is covering the Trump campaign for our co-producer WNYC on a big Trump day. Matt, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
You know, I've been reading a lot about the Rio Olympics coming up in Brazil. And have you noticed this? Have you noticed that there has barely been a single good news story out of Brazil before the games? You know, the French president said yesterday that they thwarted a terrorist attack by a Brazilian Islamist militant against the French delegation in Rio. The police force there has been on strike. There are cost overruns, infrastructure disasters, political confrontations, the ouster of the president, bodies washing up on the beach at the volleyball venue. Of course, the Zika virus. Sure, there have been one or two nice breakthrough stories. Michael Phelps is returning for the U.S. team, and the mayor of Rio is really excited for Pokemon Go to get there in time for the games. But bashing the host country is actually nothing new. Think about Athens or Beijing, even the United States, on the receiving end of tons of criticism before hosting the World Cup in 1994. Andre Markovitz is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's authored numerous books and studied comparative sports culture in Europe and North America. And he's here to deconstruct the awful news coming out of Brazil in the run-up to the games. Andre Markovitz, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is the terrible news coming out of Brazil as remarkable to you as it has been to me? Every story, story after story after story, nothing good coming out of Brazil in the run-up to the games. Is this just what we do?
Well, there is a bit of a difference with Brazil, which is, of course, the Zika virus. That is unique. You mentioned all these other negative things that always accompany mega events for lots of reasons, sometimes quite different. The United States and the World Cup were vilified because, of course, it was the United States at the time, and maybe even still, was not a soccer country. So it was seen as if the Winter Olympics would be held in Senegal. I mean, it was something totally inappropriate. But that's a very different reason than the negative things that were mentioned about Athens, Sochi, London. Those were almost always about the failure of the organization, building not being complete, people not ready, of course, hotel prices jacked up, all kinds of things like that. But it rarely, or in fact, I don't recall ever there being this issue of health. And that, of course, is quite unique. Now, about the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, the president, that is just sort of part of the package of always having a critical assessment of these Olympics. And I would actually argue that the mega events held in developing countries, such as, for example, South Africa, even, of course, China, and now with Brazil, the negative is even higher. In South Africa, if you call the World Cup 2010, again, issues of safety, things that did not come up with London and the others held in the first world.
So part of this aspect of the media culture we've seen before is sort of a lot of naysaying and foreboding coverage before the big event. Zika might be different because it's a real health issue. And then what happens in the history of sporting mega events? Do the flame gets lit, the events start, and everybody forgets about the bad
exactly.
stuff and just focuses?
Exactly, exactly. The flame gets lit. There's the brilliant opening ceremony, which is, interestingly, with the closing ceremony, the most watched of all the events, showing you that it's sort of a sports is almost incidental. But, of course, there comes the feel-good event for the nation that hosts it, hosts disproportionately and, in fact, by vast amounts, gain in terms of medals. There's the home field advantage is huge. It's a feel-good story for the host nation. I mean, everybody, basically nationalism kicks in, which is the most powerful unifying force in the 20th century or probably even before. Just remember how the Brits went totally gaga over the Olympics in London, delighting about beating the Germans and the Australians in their medal hall. This was a huge issue, almost rivaling the United States.
Right. So Andrei Markovits, let me ask you the key question here, though. What does it say about us that we do this over and over, that we're always so negative and nasty going into the big event, and then it's all washed away and we're so wonderful once it starts and once it's over?
No. It's only washed away during, and then, of course, the postmortems develop, which, in fact, are also often negative, and, in fact, scathingly so. I mean, the Montreal Olympics was held in 1976. The postmortem negativity, I think, lasted until a couple of years ago. Basically, the huge the cost overruns, the unnecessary buildings. A very distinguished colleague of mine here at the University of Michigan, Stefan Szymanski, just did a study of the London Olympics, which he shows that the buildings were, I mean, the whole construction, all that was really fraught with difficulty, and the development of London could have been very different. So the post-mortem is not always positive. Basically, the press the media have a role of, you know this better than I do, negativity sells much better. And, you know, journalists like to kvetch, and people worry about these mega events. And let us not forget that at least in the developed world, what has also happened is a fatigue over these mega events. Increasingly, people in Europe and North America are very wary of having them. So typically, the next Winter Olympics were only contested by Kazakhstan and South Korea. The Austrians declined, so this declined, that declined. So in fact, there's a much more critical assessment on the part of the public what the benefit of these mega events is, and maybe just this phenomenal high of the 2 weeks of the duration may not in fact suffice. So I don't think that it's only the lead up that makes us sort of being nasty and kvetchy and crabby that leads to this assessment that you're now seeing with Brazil.
Nasty, kvetchy, crabby, leading up to the big games. We've seen this before. Andrei Markovits has seen it before. He studies comparative sports culture in Europe and North America, professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Professor Markovits, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We do have a caller on the line right now, so I want to get to him. Anthony, let your voice be heard.
There was a time when police officers policed the neighborhoods in which they served. Moving forward, you have police officers who are going into unknown, uncharted territory, and they're policing neighborhoods in which they do not serve and they do not live in.
I want to say that they're not Muslims, they are extremists, okay? There's a difference.
You just totally disregarded an emergency two blocks away, you know, just to go around the block to give someone a ticket.
And it sounds ugly, but I mean, you know, America's ugly. America can be very ugly sometimes.
Those voices you're hearing belong to callers reacting to violence by and against police last week, airing frustrations and opinions on Let Your Voice Be Heard Radio. It's produced out of WHCR here in New York City, and it's an outlet for a lot of New Yorkers struggling with how to respond to the violence and division across American communities today. It's hosted by two young people, Stanley Fritz, who's a community organizer, and Selena Hill. She's a multimedia journalist at Black Enterprise, and they're determined to help motivate the conversations of other millennials trying to make sense of their world and turn some of that dialogue that you're hearing into action. Selena says that for a lot of young people today, particularly young people of color, the defining feature of their experience is watching it play out live together.
Our listeners are extremely outraged and frustrated. It's disheartening. And if we think about it, you know, now that we're in this era of social media, we're exposed to these new levels of horror. I've never witnessed someone die before until I watched Eric Garner be killed by police in Staten Island. I mean, it's, I would say that we as millennials, as viewers, as regular civilians are also dealing with trauma because we've never witnessed or seen anything to this magnitude or this level before. And it's definitely spilled over into our daily lives where, you know, we're ready to take some type of action, whether that's going to a march or a protest rally in Union Square or calling our legislators and telling them enough is enough.
Stanley, what's happened, though, over the last week is that this conversation, this ongoing conversation and outrage over black men and the police has become tied to police getting killed. You saw President Obama go to Dallas and had to talk about both things tied together. And that's a far more complex conversation than even we were having before.
Before I answer that question, I just want to mention that black women have also been being killed by the police. We don't want to forget about Sandra Bland. And even though, you know, it's been ruled a suicide, we don't want to forget about how she got into prison in the first place. In relation to black men being killed by police officers, we've been seeing this for a while. Police officers being killed by black men or having those conversations merged, I don't think it's appropriate. When an officer is killed, when they find that killer, they get justice. But when you kill a person of color, particularly a black man or a black woman, even if it's on camera, even if the entire world sees you choking them to death or shooting them, there's still questions of, oh, did they have a gun? Were they a thug? Were they being dangerous? And that's very problematic. If it was just Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, Obama would not be going to Dallas. And thankfully enough, he and President George Bush, to his credit, they were able to and they were willing to kind of address all of those issues and not just the officers.
Selena, you talked about seeing all these killings on video and how you've seen so many now. It seems to me this is a phenomenon that's fundamentally different for millennials. We've had older folks on The Takeaway many times who've said, this is the type of violence that we've been telling you about for 100 years. The difference is iPhones. And for millennials, it's sort of always been iPhones.
Yes, Todd, you are absolutely right. You know, these are the horror stories that my grandmother experienced when she grew up in the Deep South. And my mother, who's a baby boomer, also experienced. And even my uncle, who's also experienced a great deal of police brutality himself, so much that he lost sight in his left eye. But for me, you know, I heard the stories. And now when I go on Twitter, I see the hashtags. And when I turn on the news, I'm seeing live video or video that was captured by someone who happened to be a bystander, like in the case of Walter Scott, who was shot down by a police officer 8 times in the back in South Carolina. So you're right, it is a new phenomenon. And I think that we as millennials have not found the proper way to really vent. We don't know how to deal with this. So for the most part, I think that we're all calling out for like some type of healing. I would say that, you know, if there's any good in this situation and having these videos there, number one, it's validated the stories that black people have been feeling and talking about forever. And number two, it's definitely incited a call to action where we as millennials are doing something. We're doing more than just tweeting about it. We're doing more than just telling our friends or sitting at home, but we're going out in the streets. We vocalize our pain and our frustrations, whether that's in a t-shirt or a wristband or actually going to a community board meeting. I just say that it's definitely calling us to action and we're taking those actions in different ways.
Stanley Fritz, what has been the impact of your radio show, do you think, in New York City that you're running every Sunday? As Selena said, Black Lives Matter, the movement, this is largely social media based, not exclusively. It does get on cable news. It does get coverage in the traditional media. What are you able to do on the radio waves, do you think, at this point?
Since we've started this show, we have had a million hoodies on there. We have had members of the Justice League on there. We have had members of the Black Lives Matter movement on there. We had Bob Hudgens from Ferguson, Missouri, who was out there on the front lines after Mike Brown was murdered by Officer Darren Wilson. We put them on the radio and shared their story. And we've done it in a way that the people who care about these things can understand. And I think one of the things that we always try to lead the shows with, no matter how depressing or uplifting everything is with the call to action. The show we did this past Sunday, we had calls to action spread out throughout the entire segment where we were giving different meetups and marches that were happening throughout the week in New York City.
All right. So, Stanley, it's your show along with Selena. It's your air. President Obama has called for a deeper conversation where you take in as much as you give. Who's your ultimate guest right now? You can snap your fingers and get your ultimate guest. Don't say President Obama. That's too easy.
Oh, man.
Is it David Duke? Is it the commissioner of police for St. Louis? Who's your ultimate guest?
If David Duke came to the show, I might get into a fight. So not David
Duke.
I take Paul Ryan.
Why?
And here's why. Because he double talks. He gave me a really impressive speech last week where he said, don't blame Black Lives Matter for the Dallas shooter. I really appreciated that. But then in the next step, he'll try to pass a bill that disproportionately affects poor Black and Latino people or poor people or gay people or women. And I'd really like to have a conversation with him about how those two things can connect in his head and what we need to do to be allies in a way that helps all people.
Selena?
Donald Trump. And here's the reason why. Number one, I mean, the things that come out of this man's mouth are just so horrendous and only set us back. I would love to take him on in my studio on my turf. And number two, maybe even if he didn't show it on air, he can walk away and say, you know what? I need to start thinking about things a little more critically. One of the biggest problems in this country is everyone is just so divided on this huge spectrum. You have the right and you have the left. And at the end of the day, people are dying. And I think that our humanity is something that can unite us.
Part of community organizing is a voice in the community, and Let Your Voice Be Heard Radio is just that in New York City and Harlem on WHCR 90.3 FM. Selena Hill and Stanley Fritz are the co-hosts. Guys, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
You might be spending some time in the car before the summer's over, I think, maybe some time by the pool. You might want to listen to a podcast, and there are a ton of options out there, dozens, hundreds, in fact. Melissa Locker is here. She writes for The Guardian and Time.com. We asked her to curate a few out of the many hundreds of podcasts you could be listening to this summer.
Obviously, politics is a huge area for podcasts. And one of the newer ones, which is also, in my opinion, one of the best, coming out of the box strong, was Politically Reactive, which teams up Kamau Bell with Hari Kondabolu. Two comedians, two really strong voices. They're funny, they're smart, and they have a really, really interesting take on politics.
We've got all kinds of voices on this show. Politicians, activists, artists, academics, noisemakers, rabble-rousers, birthday clowns, Rachel Dolezal.
Wait, we got Rachel Dolezal?
No, we don't have Rachel Dolezal. Not because we can't get her. I just don't really want to talk to her. And they're all here to help us make sense of politics in America. Because Black Jesus, we all need some help.
This might actually be the week to get into it and download it since it's convention time. We're heading into a contentious, potentially Republican convention. Hillary's going to be coronated. It seems like the time for a little bit of political comedy might be ripe.
Right. And these two have just really smart, strong takes on everybody.
So I don't know how much downtime I'm going to have for The Takeaway when we're at the conventions, but I like to spend some of my downtime, if I have it, on true crime. I haven't found much that I loved since Making a Murderer, which is a television show, Netflix series, not a podcast. And I've kind of been hungry for that, Melissa.
So there's a couple shows. One is a relatively new one called Untold, which tells the story of the murder of Danny Morgan.
30 years ago, a private detective was brutally murdered, and it still hasn't been solved. I'm Peter Jukes, and I'll be exploring how one man and his family began to unravel the truth.
Well, he had this story he's going to sell to the press.
I mean, I know that he knew that there were corrupt police officers.
I was hanging on to my mental health by the skin of my teeth.
This is a very serial-esque unpacking the case, getting to the details. Do they have a hope of upending the case the way Serial has gotten Adnan Syed a new trial?
I think there's always that hope. It's an unsolved murder, so they have no clues. So I think whatever they can shake up with more attention and more spotlight is going to be helpful.
All right, so what else do you want to throw in there? It's summer. Everybody's traveling. What do you got?
Well, if you're traveling and you happen to be in the car with your kids, there's a new show called Eleanor Amplified, which is aimed squarely at children. So there have been a few things like a lot of music shows and some science shows, but Eleanor Amplified is an actual serial radio drama. aimed at children. It comes out of WHYY in Philadelphia, and it's really well produced, and it's a really fun, engaging story, which is actually fun for the whole family.
Join our hero, the world-famous radio reporter Eleanor Amplified, as she foils evil schemes.
Pirates.
Man-eating snakes.
Robots. Cat videos.
Outwits cunning villains.
No! My laboratory!
And gets the big story.
What was that?
So good for the car ride, good for plugging into the console when you're on the highway.
Yeah, and good for, way for just, you know, to get your kid away from you for 5 minutes.
Plug the kid in on the airplane.
Right.
Throw something else at us from science or pop culture or politics that you like.
If you want to combine pop culture and politics, you really can't do better than The West Wing Watch. It's Josh Molina, who people may now know from Scandal.
And wait, West Wing Watch?
The West Wing
is this,
Watch.
Is this reporting on Barack Obama's West Wing?
No. It is reporting on The West Wing. Yeah, this is about the TV show, the once and future President Bartlet.
All right, but West Wing hasn't been on NBC for years. What is he doing?
So Josh Molina is going back and watching every single episode and reporting on it. And it sounds potentially boring, but it's really not. It's actually, it's hilarious, it's insightful, and it's compelling lesson. And it really makes you want to go back and watch the entire series all over again.
That's Melissa Locker, who helps us out with culture on the internet and off this week. Podcasts for your travel, political, and true crime needs. Melissa Locker, thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
And you can head over to the website at thetakeaway.org to see Melissa's full list of podcasts and links on how to download them.
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You still don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
Oh, you just don't get it, do you?
Huh? You don't get it, do you?
Friday is the day for weekend movie releases here on The Takeaway. And here with me is Rafer Guzman, our resident film critic and film critic for Newsday. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
We got three movies to get to. If people are expecting trivia, which they might be, we got to skip it today, unfortunately. We're a little short on time, but you have a Woody Allen movie called Cafe Society. I love a Woody Allen period piece. This one takes place in the 30s. Here's a clip.
Well, if I was your boyfriend, I would not travel. Or if I did, I would take you with me. I hope he knows how to kiss you and all the rest.
It's between us.
All right, that sounded like Jesse Eisenberg, who I loved in Zombieland, and Kristen Stewart, who is amazing in The Runaways.
That's right. Yeah, they're both Jesse Eisenberg plays a Jewish kid from New York who comes to Hollywood. Surprise, surprise. Kristen Stewart is the lovely assistant to a big shot producer that Jesse Eisenberg meets. Yeah, this is a period piece. It's no match for Midnight in Paris. It doesn't quite have the charm and the sparkle of that piece. But
and I love Bullets Over Broadway. Some people.
Oh, I love Bullets Over Broadway. Yeah. Great, great movie. You know, this is not going to stand up to those movies. But you know, Woody Allen, he draws these characters in very broad scale. Sketches and they work, and even though the characters are often inconsistent and contradictory, they seem alive to me. And Woody Allen does that bittersweet kind of tone better than anyone I can think of, and this movie's got that, and I liked it a lot.
And so that means so often with these Woody Allen movies, even if you say, oh, it's not Annie Hall, it's not Bullets Over Broadway, you're still probably going to enjoy it.
By the standards of late period Woody Allen, I think this is above average, I would say.
And now let's go to a sequel. This is a big sequel. I'm going to back announce this one, play you the clip, because this is one of the biggest part twos probably we've seen in a long time.
You didn't disclose that the vehicle was going to be a hearse.
I'm sorry. My uncle owns a funeral home, not an enterprise rent-a-car.
Hope you checked to see there wasn't a body in the back.
I don't really know.
You didn't check?
I mean, I was in a hurry. I checked to see if we had gas. That was more important.
That's Ghostbusters 2, Rafer Guzman. It's huge.
Now, I've got to correct you on this. This is a reboot, not a sequel. That's very important.
Did I say sequel?
It's very important what this movie is trying to do. They're trying to reinvent Ghostbusters. Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, Kristen Wiig, Leslie Jones. Whole new Ghostbusters, whole new plot. However, the problem is that they keep nodding back to the original so often. That car you're hearing about, same car. They try to rent the same space that the original Ghostbusters did. Same ghosts. We don't see the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in the climax, but it's a very similar looking ghost to that. And the problem is that keeps the movie from establishing its own identity. You keep wondering, well, what happened? Why is this movie taking place now when we feel like the original Ghostbusters already happened? They can never quite create their own universe, their own storyline, and it's a little disappointing to me.
And part of the danger with a movie like this is there is a danger of saying, oh, same old movie, but with women this time, it seems like they could have done more.
And it's not enough. And I don't want to be one of the many women haters that have started the backlash against this movie, but I just don't think these characters work, the jokes don't quite land, and it just doesn't feel like its own movie.
All right, now lastly, the infiltrator, Bryan Cranston, was here on The Takeaway earlier this week talking about his new film.
We need you to fix this for us.
How am I going to fix this? You want me to call Senator Kerry? Hey, John, could you drop your investigation that the president has sanctioned? Because my friend Bob's getting really upset.
Bryan Cranston, John Leguizamo's in this one. U.S. Customs official uncovers a big money laundering scheme.
Yeah, real story. Bryan Cranston plays Bob Mazur, who goes undercover to try to take down Pablo Escobar's drug trafficking ring. Interestingly, he goes after the bank to try to stop the money, and that's an interesting part of this. This is great counter-programming for the summer. Smart, well-thought-out adult drama, great cast. Bryan Cranston, Diane Kruger, Benjamin Bratt plays one of the Escobar's lieutenants. It works really well, and I like this as an old-fashioned, solid procedural. A lot of fun.
This is a Bryan Cranston performance that measures up to all the other great ones, Breaking Bad, but also All the Way on HBO, where he plays LBJ.
You know what? He's great. He's a disappearing actor. That's what I love about him. He disappears in these roles, and he does that here. He's wonderful at it.
That's The Infiltrator, Rafer Guzman, film critic from Newsday, bringing us up to date on the new Ghostbusters, on Cafe Society, the new one, a period piece from Woody Allen, and of course, The Infiltrator, starring Bryan Cranston. Three films that you can check out this weekend. Rafer Guzman, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd. We'll be right back.